You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 16th of September 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
A new alliance of the UK, the US and Australia annoys China and France, the UK's new foreign secretary and the challenges awaiting her, and Russia prepares to vote for all the difference that's likely to make. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Mary Dajewski and James Rogers, will be discussing all the day's big stories, and we'll have a letter from our New York correspondent, if not necessarily from New York. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by James Rogers, Associate Professor of International Journalism at City University of London, and by Mary Dajewski, the Foreign Affairs Commentator and Columnist for The Independent. Hello to you both. Someone hasn't switched their phones off. James, honestly, really, you can't get the help. Mary, while he is trying to remember how to switch that off, we were going to talk about acronyms right now at the top of the show, because acronyms are about to come up as a thing. Do you have a particular favourite? This is a fantastic opening to a radio programme. Favourite acronyms. I'm pleased by how well this is going.
I have an absolute favourite acronym that comes out of the British treatment of the pandemic. And my favourite acronym is nerve tag, because it sounds like something out of some sort of spy thriller, whereas in fact it's quite a sort of common or garden government related committee of scientists which is looking at some aspect, and I've completely forgotten which particular aspect of the pandemic, to make recommendations. But nerve tag, just when you simply when you see it and you hear it, it sounds such a menace.
Is it actually assembled from nerve tag? That would be eight different words that have all start with N-E-R.
I think nerve comes from one bit, and then there's T-A-G, but I've completely forgotten. It's lost in the mist of time, like all the best acronyms.
Our producer, Carlotta, who is as on the ball as ever, communicates via Slack, which has now helpfully disappeared from the screen. We are off to a liquid start here today. James, while I'm trying to find where Carlotta's message went, can you tell us what your favourite acronym
is? I'm going to probably go back into the last century, Andrew, and dig out a couple from the Soviet Union. PARTORG, Party Organiser, was a favourite of mine, which actually found its echo when I was working at the BBC, because they used to have, maybe they still do, have a news org, who was the journalist on the news desk who was responsible for assigning news coverage. But I'm finally going to go for GLAVLIT, which the lit, which was literature, and it sounds like something was there to promote literature. In fact, it was the censorship organisation that was the bane of foreign correspondents' existence in Moscow in the middle of the last century.
Nerve tag, it says here, thank you, Carlotta, is new and emerging Emerging Respiratory Virus Threats Advisory Group.
So it's just as menacing as it sounds.
It is. And with that, we shall move on, though I would like to give a shout out on this front to the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, who may not have researched that one all the way through. We will start today with AUKUS, an alliance and an acronym which are going to take some getting used to. AUKUS is a new tripartite security pact involving Australia, the United Kingdom and the United States. AUKUS, you see what they have done there. The three countries are already close allies, so it's no great reorder of the global strategic balance, but the headline aspect, the provision of American nuclear submarine technology to Australia, has ruffled feathers in France, which thought it had Australia's submarine business in the bag, and China, which believes itself astutely the focus of this new arrangement. Mary, is there any earthly reason really why the constituent nations of AUKUS shouldn't do this if this is what they feel like doing?
Well, there isn't, but it's putting a whole lot of other nations' noses out of joint, which suggests that it might be creating dangers rather than actually doing away with them. While we're talking on the business of acronyms, I'd actually assumed when I heard this was going to be called AUKUS, I assumed that it was some clever sort of reference to nuclear submarines as whales. It was only later I realised that it was a combination of the countries concerned.
They may be hoping that there is some hominid anemic sort of resonance there.
And maybe that it sounds rather more elegant and more useful than actually it is. But I actually, of all the people who I feel sorry for in all this, are the French. They thought that they'd got a deal sewn up with Australia to produce submarines for them. And lo and behold, somehow, the Australians seem to have slid out of that and gone for nuclear-powered submarines. I also noticed that on some of the news bulletins this morning when this was being announced, there was almost a sort of underlined clause in reporting it that said, and we want to stress these are nuclear-powered submarines, not nuclear-armed submarines.
It's a pretty important distinction.
It's a very important distinction, but the fact that they felt it necessary to spell out suggests to me that the degree of anticipation of objections rather further afield than Australia.
James, there is an aspect to this which I think does underline Australia's interest in this, which is that Australia is vastly under-equipped on the naval front. It is an enormous country with an immense coastline, and it ranks as a naval power somewhere alongside Venezuela and Romania.
Yeah, I mean it is, but it's interesting that everybody has pointed out that China is not mentioned by name in this, but the Chinese have responded and realizing that it is exactly them, and it's interesting.
I don't think it's the Filipino menace that everybody is worried about.
It certainly doesn't seem to be, you know, and the talk about making sure of security in that part of the world. It's interesting, though, that the Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson has responded by saying that this move will intensify the arms race. Well, it's news to quite a lot of the world that we have actually got an arms race. It's interesting to hear that they're actually talking about it in such overt terms. But clearly, for this government, there are other benefits, too, for the particular British government that have made so much of their global Britain, and that hasn't in many respects got off to a fantastic start, which I'm sure we'll come on to discuss when we talk about the new Foreign Secretary. But this is some sort of big policy triumph in terms of, you know, rebuilding those ties with the English-speaking world that I think will play very well with parts of their constituency at home. And I think they're probably very aware of that, as quite aside from the strategic idea of containing or addressing what they see as the rise of China.
Mary, that is doubtless part of it, the idea of that sort of informal English-speaking alliance slightly within and slightly without NATO. And that's something that has operated in a de facto sense for quite some time. But to go back to that idea of an arms race, the UK's Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, speaking about this deal, has said that China is embarking on one of the biggest military spends in history. And he's not wrong about that, is he? And if we're thinking about China inferring that it is the focus of this new arrangement, then is it not also the case that the United States and Australia in particular are perfectly within their rights to take some of China's build-up somewhat personally?
Well, they're entirely entitled to do whatever they think is necessary in terms of their defending their national security. But I think it's quite interesting that this announcement came within 24, 48 hours of reports that China had warships patrolling off Alaska, which is a very interesting development, because until now, the British and the Americans and various other people have been sailing supposedly in the name of keeping international sea lanes open in the South China Sea. And this has become a sort of big mission, especially for the British and the Americans. And of course, if Western countries think that they want to keep sea lanes open in the South China Sea, then it's not entirely beyond the bounds of possibility that China will send some more ships off Alaska. And then we're looking at a rather interesting and potentially quite tense situation. At the same time, you could also look back to the Soviet experience and the sort of arms control, and maybe we're going to look at the possibility of some sort of arms control process being introduced with China, which so far all the running in arms control generally has been made between the US and the EU. And Russia as the heir to the Soviet Union, and any attempt to bring in China has really failed.
James, is there an argument, though, that this kind of arrangement and possible other arrangements yet to come are somewhat overdue, that the countries in which China might be taking an interest do need to start thinking about how they might want to respond to that possibility.
Yeah, because I mean, in many ways, we're in completely, well, continue the naval metaphor, uncharted waters here, in the sense that if we look back to the Cold War of the last century, there was those sharp divisions, and they, because of the threat of nuclear confrontation, arms controls eventually came in. What the huge distinction this time is that there is not such a sharp dividing ideology, although one could argue that's perhaps emerging. But there is this very, very important mutual relationship of trade, which was completely absent when you had the world, at least the Northern Hemisphere, divided between socialism and capitalism.
The United States was in no respect economically dependent on the Soviet Union.
Exactly. And nor indeed was the Soviet Union really that dependent on it exported oil and grain occasionally, but it wasn't anything like the foreign trade was nothing like it is for China. Mm. So I think this is why it's going to be a very interesting relationship. We see time and time again the discussion about the relationship between the United States and China, and speculation that there are some things they need to cooperate on. Climate change is one that's going to be in the news very much in the coming weeks before the UN climate conference. But I think that's one very big distinction, where there may be some sort of threat or of eventual military confrontation, but at the same time, there are these economic ties which didn't exist during the Cold War in the last century.
Just a final quick thought on this, Mary. There have also been, at least until quite recently, very tight economic ties between Australia and China. Now, it's been notable that that relationship has become substantially less friendly than it once was over recent years. Does this suggest to you that Australia has now more or less given up on it and thought that maybe China's sort of enormous demand at one point for Australian resources has served its purpose?
Well, it does look rather like that. And I think another aspect of this is quite long-standing Australian public opinion that politicians will obviously take account of. But, you know, I remember being in Australia maybe 15, 20 years ago, and already there was quite strong hostility towards China at a grassroots level, not at the top political level. And it seems that that's finally, for whatever reason, filtered its way up to the top, obviously with China spending much more on its defence and looking much more assertive in Asia.
Well, let's move along somewhat, because sticking with the theme of the world stage, there is a new player thereon. When the music stopped at the end of yesterday's UK government cabinet reshuffle, the Foreign Secretary's chair was occupied by Liz Truss, previously Trade Secretary. Truss is the second woman to have held the role, so there's that, and she isn't Dominic Raab, so there's also that. She shall be representing Britain abroad as soon as next week, accompanying Prime Minister Boris Johnson to the UN General Assembly in New York City. James, it's said that, at least in terms of next week's visit to the UN, that rekindling the relationship with the US is said to be high on the agenda. Obviously, the new AUKUS thing will be part of that. But how far is the relationship right now from sort of peak special relationship love-in, do you think?
I have to declare here, Andrew, that I've always been deeply cynical about the idea of a special relationship. I think there's a lot of examples as to why it hasn't really worked. And one of, you know, we had one very recently, a much bigger one than this AUKUS, at least in the recent past, which is the way that the United States withdrew its forces from Afghanistan almost without, certainly without really consulting the United Kingdom, which I think said two things, mainly. Firstly, the limits of the special relationship, and secondly, too, that the current government's idea post-Brexit of global Britain, of a Britain that will be open to much more to the wider world rather than just to European neighbours, also has its limits, because I think it also exposed that the United Kingdom, from that point of view, is entirely reliant on the United States' presence to continue its own military presence in Afghanistan. So I think this is obviously going to give it a boost, but let's also remember that the relationship between the current US administration and Boris Johnson is not fantastic. Many of those members of President Biden's team remember some of the more regrettable remarks that Boris Johnson made about Barack Obama when he was in office. And of course, a lot of those members of the administration also served under President Obama. So I don't think that it's necessarily going to be that warm, particularly when we remember the former president said that Johnson was known, as the former president did, said things without providing any evidence, that he was known as Britain Trump when talking of Mr. Johnson once.
Mary, let's take a closer look at Liz Truss. She is said to be the most popular cabinet minister among Tory voters, and that possibly explains at two levels why she has got the job. There's one, there is the fact that she's popular and so that's good, and therefore that giving her a high profile job will please Tory voters, but also it gets her out of the country, which prime ministers are usually quite keen to do with possible rivals. See also Theresa May and Boris Johnson when he was Foreign Secretary. What is, do you think, the secret of Liz Truss's appeal among the people she appeals to?
Well, I have to say that I've never quite understood why she's managed to top practically every popularity poll for cabinet members in the Conservative grassroots. Because, I mean, Liz Truss is not hugely visible, or she hasn't been since she became a cabinet member. It's not as though she's out there every day. She's not Home Secretary. She's not. She hasn't been Foreign Secretary. She hasn't been every day on the radio explaining government position. Now, you know, you might say, well, that's kept her out of trouble. But I think one of the reasons may be that she is seen as a straight down the line traditional conservative in the image of conservative grassroots organisations in the English shires. She is very keen on private enterprise. She remains, it appears, hostile to a greater role for the state, despite Boris Johnson's general response to the pandemic in that respect. And she's also been, as business secretary, she's been sort of the standard bearer for the commercial aspect of global Britain. And, you know, you and I might look at the various agreements that the British have concluded since Brexit as being really nothing like the trade arrangements, the free trade arrangements that were available to the UK when it was part of the European Union. Nonetheless, there have been just about enough of those agreements, however small they may be, to give an impression that trade relations with other parts of the world are being enhanced, resurrected. So I think she's seen in that respect as being competent and of having done a reasonable job. And I suppose, you know, in the context of the last cabinet in particular, that's a recommendation already.
James, what do you think she's going to... I mean, I guess what I'm trying to ask there is, what challenges do you think do face her as she tries to represent Britain abroad? Because what we do understand of her grasp of diplomacy so far is perhaps not encouraging. As Trade Secretary, she, for example, sent as a business envoy to Australia Ian Botham, the former England Test cricketer, which is a little like sending Satan to the Vatican.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why, you know, many of the current cabinet have got senior jobs in this country is their unwavering loyalty on Brexit and their dedication to current government policy. And I think Liz Truss is a prime example of that. And being Foreign Secretary in this country doesn't necessarily require you to have had a lot of international experience prior to that either. So I think she is going to, she's also, you know, it's, but it is a very, very big job. And it is a job which has gone on to lead to becoming Prime Minister several times previously, Boris Johnson being the most recent example. She's only in her mid-40s. I think she could have a very long career ahead of her, and she may quite possibly see herself eventually as a Prime Minister. So I think, you know, I would imagine that... this is a job that she will hope to do competently, will hope to build up that this idea of global Britain that the government's so keen on, and then return possibly to another job in the future. But I think the main challenges are going to be getting trade going again. You know, one of the problems that we've got in this country at the moment is a lack of HGV drivers. That doesn't sound like a massive thing for the Foreign Secretary, but it's to do with the fact that it's harder for Europeans to come and work here. That, as everyone, I'm quite sure, who lives in this country will have noticed, is leading to shortages in shops.
There is another aspect of her appointment as well, which is that it brings a woman, another woman, into a very prominent position in Boris Johnson's cabinet. And he has been criticised in the past for a lack of women at the top of government. And having Liz Truss in this very visible role does create the impression of, you know, the moment you have Liz Truss representing the UK abroad, instead of, say, the straight down the line, very stern lawyer Dominic Raab, you see a completely different image. And I think that may that may have been some consideration like that behind Boris Johnson's choice.
Mary Dejewski and James Rogers, thank you both for the moment. This is the Monocle Daily. We will have more from our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. The world is a better place when people have more courage than fear, especially in uncertain times. People seek stability and confidence. By supporting each other and sharing resources across the world, Allianz has helped people to overcome their fears and look to the future with hope and with real confidence. Marika Dotschardis is a middle and long distance runner, a former acrobat and a sports psychologist who works with client athletes to help them unlock, build and maintain confidence. Marika, it's great to talk with you. Speaking as an athlete but also as a sports psychologist, what are the biggest challenges of being an athlete?
In my opinion, one of the biggest challenges is social comparison. And that has gotten even more intense with social media now. As human beings, we are wired for connection and for community because in the past it guaranteed our survival and it was necessary for our survival. And that's why this need for belonging to other people is still deeply ingrained in our nervous system, and it's therefore connected to our emotional reaction and also our stress reaction. And it's something that we all need. And this drive to compare ourselves with other people is connected to that longing for community because we want to know if we belong to other people and we compare ourselves to others to see if we match up with them. That's why it's a normal mechanism. And fighting against that with sayings like, don't compare yourself to other people because you are unique, is somewhat not helpful just because it's a human desire that's ingrained in all of us and that we cannot fight and we cannot basically stop. We have to just figure out how we can manage that need to compare ourselves in a more productive manner by, for instance, selecting wisely who we compare ourselves to and by being mindful of the thoughts that are going through our mind when we scroll through social media and by being mindful of who we follow on social media and I'm being mindful of who do we take criticism from? Like, why do we take criticism from everybody, but we never take compliments from other people? So just being mindful of who is allowed to give you opinions that really matter in your life.
Marika Dotschardis on unlocking, building and maintaining confidence today and tomorrow. With Allianz, you can take confidence in tomorrow. Allianz, behind you for what's ahead.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Mary Dejewski and James Rogers. This weekend, Russia votes in parliamentary elections. Polls don't open until tomorrow, so plenty of time to get some cans and snacks in to keep you going as you stay up all night to watch the results come in. It's going to be a squeaker and so forth. The pro-Kremlin United Russia Party, at the risk of giving away the ending, will win and will nigh certainly retain the two-thirds Duma majority it needs to continue rewriting the Constitution to allow President Vladimir Putin to stay in office until our Earth is swallowed by a dying sun. Mary, are these elections the total charade that I have blithely assumed in that extremely glib introduction?
Well, I think there are certain things to watch for. I mean, these...
Not the result.
the small print of the result, if not the overall result. One of the interesting things about it is the extent to which the Kremlin has basically wiped out the opposition, or at least the pro-Western opposition. The fact that it's made such efforts, not just putting Alexei Navalny, the most famous oppositionist, in prison camp, but also it's forced a lot of opposition people, including his supporters, his activists, into exile abroad, or it's arrested them, taken them off the political scene, it's stopped people from running. So why has it taken such efforts that it hasn't taken to that extent in previous parliamentary or regional elections? And that suggests that there is a degree of concern in the Kremlin that things might not go completely according to the script. The two things that I would watch for that I think are quite interesting, one of them is turnout, because if people decide that indeed these elections are such a charade that they don't really see any reason to show up for them, then that looks like quite a defeat for the Kremlin. I mean, it may very well start massaging the figures. You can't rule that out. But if you have a really, really low turnout, that in itself is a defeat and expression of no confidence that the Kremlin won't want. The other thing which I think people have pointed out, and I think is quite interesting, is how are the communists going to do? Because one of the tactics that Navalny, now in prison, was recommending, and which is still being recommended through his sort of agents, is that voters vote for the candidate most likely to topple the ruling United Russia Party candidate. And in a lot of constituencies, that is going to be the communist. And I've watched over the last 10 or so years how the Communist Party has made a little bit, by small steps, it's made a bit of a comeback, and it's got some sort of renewed appeal among younger Russians with its platform of anti-corruption, egalitarianism, social justice, all those sort of things. And there is a view that if anybody is going to do relatively well in these elections, it could be the communists. And if the communists have a stronger presence in the new parliament or Duma, then life might become marginally more difficult for the ruling party.
James, it is an interesting one, because it does sound counterintuitive, but it's nevertheless the case that even dictatorships, and I think Russia probably just about qualifies as such, do rely to an extent on some amount of consent. There's any number of historical examples, not least in Russia, in fact, of a given dictatorship taking too much for granted and pushing its luck too far, and it all going a bit wrong for them. Are they nervous specifically, though, for all the reasons Mary mentions, but also about the recent example of Belarus, where Lukashenko clearly massively overplayed his hand, and though he is still in power, the last year or so has not been as he would have wished?
Yeah, I think that's a very important factor. If we think back to the early years of this century, if we think back to the so-called colour revolutions, the Rose Revolution in Georgia and the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, that was the last time we really saw Russia this nervous that something like this might happen there. And I think it's absolutely remarkable. I mean, in Vladimir Putin, you have a leader who has been at the top of Russian politics for more than two decades. I would say, I'd be interested to hear Mary's views on this, as another former Russia correspondent and observer, I would say the rapidity and the severity of the crackdown over the last 12 months, I think, has taken me by surprise. It's no secret that for the last 10 or 15 years, political freedoms have been limited, freedom of expression has been limited, but the real repressive power of the state that's been brought to bear in the last 12 months is, I think, quite remarkable and does suggest a degree of nervousness. Now, for the short term, I think that can probably work, and it has done so far. I don't think there's any prospect of the opposition making a serious showing. Mary's point about turnout is an extremely valid one, and it might be interesting to share with listeners the fact that Russian ballot papers traditionally had an option for against everybody. That was removed. That's been removed during which I personally have often felt like that in UK elections, actually. We at least had the option of spoiling our ballot paper. That is long gone, though, because they were worried about that, you know, getting a large 5% of the votes. So I think it is going to be very interesting. I don't think we're going to see any change in the short term, but I think Mary's right. There are small details to look for, because precisely because President Putin's administration does need some form of legitimacy from this vote.
It is a shame they did away with that. Aside from anything else, none of the above sounds like quite a good Russian president's name. Mary, do you get any sense that Russia's public are anywhere near some sort of tipping or breaking point? I mean, all the things you've both described have been preludes to some sort of eruption in many other cases in Russia and elsewhere. The government cracks down just that little bit too far and things can come unglued very quickly.
Yes. I mean, however hard leaders try to control elections, elections are nonetheless quite dangerous. Because even if you think you've got everything under control, look at what happened in Georgia. Look at what happened in Ukraine. What happened in Ukraine twice. You get huge numbers of people out on the streets and things get very easily out of hand. And, you know, most recently we've seen Belarus. Now, I don't get the sense, though, you know, you can be very wrong, that Russia is actually at that tipping point right now. I think there are other interesting things happening in Russia. There are interesting things happening in the regions with a greater sense of regional identity and a sense among voters in regional elections that they want their candidate and they don't want to be overruled by the Kremlin, as has seemed to happen on some occasions. But what I do think, and may partly lie behind the crackdown before these elections, is that one of the reasons Putin has been so relatively calm and untroubled in power until recently was that he always seemed to me to have a very uncanny sense of what Russians wanted, what would keep Russians happy, and to be just a slight move ahead of them. And that he had this very true sense of where the country was. And I felt that about a year ago, maybe, he started to lose that. And I just wonder whether, to that extent, his grip on power is being loosened. How it all ends, of course, is another matter. But I think that the sense that Putin had of the country he was in charge of, that is becoming less sure-footed than it used to be.
Well, we will doubtless discuss the results all across next week's dailies and other shows here on Monocle 24. But now, to give our panel a chance to be that person in the joke about how you know when someone doesn't have a television. If you haven't heard the joke, the answer to that question is they'll tell you. Here in the UK, the broadly youth-oriented channel BBC Three is set to return to normal TV 5 years after it was punted into the online realm in the belief that kids today found the idea of watching a thing at an appointed time somewhat quaint. BBC Three did quite well in exile, delivering what became proper normal TV hits, such as Fleabag, Killing Eve, and Normal People, two of which weren't awful. James, what do we glean from this? Is scheduled appointment TV still actually a thing?
I'm not really convinced that it is, actually. I think we gleaned from this is that the BBC had an idea that they thought was a good idea 5 years ago and have decided that perhaps it wasn't a very good idea after all. I think it's a reflection of how difficult it is for traditional media to survive and thrive in the current environment. So I think I personally find it rather a surprising move, because I don't think young people do have TV. As you said in the introduction, I'm a university lecturer. I don't think many of my students have TVs. They watch stuff on their computers and they watch it when they feel like it. And those people who do have TVs often these days have apps on their TV anyway. So I think the distinction is probably slightly lost. But I'm not sure this is going to necessarily lead to a surge in BBC Three viewing figures. But although, as you say, it did pretty well in exile, so I'm not really sure why they felt this was necessary.
Mary, do you still sit down ever to watch a television programme at the appointed hour like some hillbilly?
I regret to say that I do. And I also deeply regret that the BBC, for reasons it claims of its having such a predominant position in UK media, doesn't have what I find the most useful service of all the other channels, which is a plus one, so you can watch something an hour later. I know you have iPlayer, you have all these other sort of gadgets attached to television to make it flexible. But, you know, I like to know that the news is going to be at 10 o'clock and it gives a sort of structure to the evening. And without that, if the news doesn't appear at 10 o'clock, then I think the nation should be quite
alarmed. Anarchy is loosed upon the world.
Exactly.
Just finally, before I let you both go, we do have an opportunity here to do the thing which the media enjoys doing most, which is talking about itself. There is to be another news channel launched here in the UK, we learned today. This will be News Corp's new offering, which appears, James, to be basically the template they're going to run on with is, what's everything GB News did? Let's not do that.
Well, these two channels, when their planned launches were announced some time ago, people were wondering whether there's going to be sufficient room for them in the market. I suspect in a year or two's time, the answer will be a very firm no, because GB News, with the departure of its chairman and lead presenter this week, is the media commentators are not giving it much chance to survive, and it hasn't really punched through on the ratings, to put it mildly. So I think it's going to look at that. I think there are big questions over whether there is room in the UK media market for another TV news channel, although, you know, if I can't honestly say that I shared the editorial views of GB News, but as a journalist, I'm always pleased to see newcomers into the media market, and in a way I think it's a shame that it hasn't thrived, but I must admit I'm not somebody who would really want to watch Nigel Farage tonight or whatever it's called, so maybe I wasn't the target audience.
Not regularly at 10 o'clock.
Not even.
Mary, what do you think? Is that, assuming that this new thing is going to be a relatively sane, mainstream, non-headbangery offering, is there room not already occupied by the BBC and Sky in which it can flourish?
Well, you know, that would be my chief misgiving, because, you know, here am I, as I was going on about wanting predictability and in the timings and things, but you also switch to 24-hour news when something's happening, when there's an important running story. And it seems, even with the BBC and Sky, Where is a third channel doing that same thing going to position itself? And I can't quite see. And you can't watch two channels at once, let alone three. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, in principle, I'm in favour of the more the better. But the more the better can't necessarily sustain themselves, whether through advertising or anything else.
Mary Dejewski and James Rogers, thank you both, as always, for joining us. Now, finally, on The Daily, it's usually time right about now for our letter from New York City, but this week, our correspondent and usual author of those letters is Henry Rhys Sheridan, is back in the UK. So here instead are some of his reflections on the occasion of his homecoming.
"Kick the ball," I shout at the projector screen in the bar in Brooklyn. "Kick the ball into the goal, you English mother lovers." I look around at the other people in the bar. We're all here to watch the finals of the European Football Championship. In the eyes of most of them, I seem to be passing as a lager-swilling, referee-abusing, foreign person-hating true blue English football fan. Nonetheless, I think I can detect one or two sceptics raising their eyebrows. I turn back to the projector screen and add a clarification to prove my credentials once and for all. "Or you can use your head, if you prefer," I shout near the top of my voice.
"It's Saka who got round the back! This time Sterling!"
I look around again. No one's looking at me now. The doubters have been silenced. Why am I so insecure in my status as an England football supporter? Partly it's because I only really became interested in football itself after England got to the finals. But perhaps most importantly, I'm half Welsh. While I've never felt particularly Welsh, the facts are undeniable. My mother is Welsh, and I grew up mainly in South Wales. I have to completely repress this side of myself while watching the football. If I'm not careful, a vestigial resentment of the English could rear its head and cause me to accidentally start supporting the other team. Then I really would be in a pickle. The football is over and done with now. I mention it only to provide context. The final was one of the last psychologically significant events to transpire before my first trip back to the UK in 3 years. One of the first things I do on arriving in London is to turn on the TV in the place we're staying. The BBC News at 10 is on.
Tonight at 10, jobs and prosperity must come first in any Brexit deal. The Chancellor spells out his priorities.
Hugh Edwards' dulcet Welsh proclamations are the only sounds that disturb the silence of the studio. The calm ambiance stands in contrast to the febrile atmosphere of American TV news, with its constant anxious background music and whirling graphics. It used to be possible to make a general distinction between American and British TV news. The former, sensational and partisan, the latter, measured and impartial. But since I've been away in the US, a new news channel has arrived on British television.
Good evening. I'm Andrew Neil, and this is GB News.
GB News made its debut in June. There was a lot of hoo-ha surrounding its launch. In part, this is because it is the first British news channel to be set up with an explicit political agenda. It propagates an anti-metropolitan establishment, right-leaning populist worldview. The channel had a rocky launch. First, there was a mass boycott by advertisers after a campaign by the pressure group Stop Funding Hate. Then, in July, one of the channel's presenters, Guto Harry, took the knee on air. Harry's gesture was in support of the England football players who had been targeted by racist abuse after missing penalties in the Euros finals.
And I actually, with the benefit of hindsight, I may have underestimated how close to the surface the racism still was. I actually now get it, and so much so that I think, you know, we should all take the knee. In fact, why not take the knee now and just say it's a gesture, but it's an important gesture. And, you know, it's not about me.
There was a backlash against the station by its viewers. They saw Harry's gesture as an unacceptable concession to woke culture, the antithesis of what GB News is meant to be about. They boycotted the station and Harry resigned. Like me, Guto Harry is a Welshman supporting the English football team. Andrew Neil, who was the face of the station in the lead-up to its launch and who you heard earlier, is Scottish. In fact, reading the biographies of GB News' roster of on-air talent, a pattern jumped out at me. While only 15% of the UK's population is located in Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland, 27% of GB News' on-air talent are either from the Celtic fringe or have at least one Celtic parent. That figure is even higher if you count the deposed Guto Harry. This may be a coincidence, but I think it's a reflection of complicated psycho-national forces at play. GB News' conservative worldview is closely associated with the most English parts of the country, in particular the counties in the south of England outside of London. So why are the GB News presenters who propagate this agenda so disproportionately Celtic? Maybe these rogue Celts contain within them the same self-hatred that I recognise in myself. The same neurosis that led me to shout at a projector screen in a Brooklyn bar. Some dark impulse that strives to be closer to the core of British society, closer to a cultural, social and geographical nucleus that always has been and always will be English. Unfortunately for the Celts, if this was their intention in hitching themselves to the GB News wagon, they appear to have miscalculated. Andrew Neil, by far the station's biggest asset, quit as the channel's chairman and lead presenter this week. This is surely connected to the channel's poor performance. In late June, GB News made headlines after some of its programmes gained even fewer viewers than the Welsh language version of the children's television show Paw Patrol. If that isn't a sign from the universe that the GB News Celts should jump ship along with Neil, I don't know what is. We're like one, man. We're like one.
It has been quite a journey, today's show. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Mary Dajewski and James Rogers, and to Henry Rhys Sheridan just now. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.